Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening. This morning we find the Easter community, the Acts community, the earliest of Christians gathered. And I'm going to read from the fourth chapter of Acts. We're going to stay with these verses for 3 weeks now. And this is a passage, Matt will say more about that shortly, but a passage that's pretty significant in the life of the church. So let's listen to this story together. Now the whole group of those who believed were of one heart and soul. And no one claimed private ownership of any possessions, but everything they owned was held in common. With great power, the apostles gave their testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. There was not a needy person among them, for as many as owned lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of what was sold. They laid it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to each as they had need.
Yeah, my bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, but I'm busted.
I first came across an author named Michael Lewis about 3 years ago when Sarah was pregnant with Eleanor. And I want to does anybody know Michael Lewis at all? A few hands out there. Excellent. I love when I introduce new authors for folks. Michael Lewis wrote a book called Home Game. And as an expecting parent, it was the most brilliant thing that I possibly could have been reading as Sarah was expecting our first baby. It's all about the adventures of fatherhood and the often chaos of what it's like to enter into fatherhood. And I'm well aware of that as Sarah is home today with our 2.5-year-old who is really, really sick. That fatherhood is like something you can't really expect, and he does a better job than anyone I've ever read of helping me to get into that, of preparing for that. Michael Lewis then wrote a book that many folks have probably, you might be more familiar with this one. It's Moneyball. It became a Hollywood movie not too long ago. He lives over in Berkeley, but his very best two books are his more recent ones, and the first one is called The Short Side. And what he does in this book is, it's called The Big Short. I'm naming it wrong. I don't want to mess up the name. The Big Short. And basically in The Big Short, what he does for people like me that I don't understand macro finance, I don't understand I don't understand how finances work in my own family most of the time, much less how they work on a global scale, he helps people like me make sense of the housing collapse and the crisis. And then he's just recently put out a book called Boomerang. And Boomerang goes from the housing collapse here in the United States and helps us to think about the global financial collapse that we're experiencing. But what he does best is he takes these big concepts and he makes them understandable for folks like me by putting flesh on bones is what I would say. He tells real people's stories about how they were affected by all of this. And he tells an arc of a huge story just through the simplicity of one person's story. So instead of eyes glazing over about credit default swaps on collateralized debt obligations, that's what happens to me. Like the eyes go over. But when I hear people's stories, it starts to make a lot more sense to me. So he opens this new book called Boomerang, talking about one of the people that he interviewed for his initial book, The Big Short, that he ended up not including this story. And this is a hedge fund manager who lives in Dallas, Texas, and his name is Kyle Bass. And as Michael Lewis paints pictures of people, this is one of the more memorable, and he paints really memorable pictures of almost everyone that he touches on. See, Bass, back in 2008, he wrote about it this way. The bad loans made by highly paid financiers working in the private sector were being eaten by national treasuries and central banks everywhere. Okay, so that's a way of saying all of the debt that these people were foreclosing on, the debt that was going away, it was being picked up. It didn't just disappear. National governments were taking it on. So this person named Bass, he started to bet that governments, entire economies, would collapse. They'd go bankrupt. So a couple years ago, he placed an $1,100 bet that the economy in Greece would collapse. And for that $1,100 that he put up, he made $700,000. But this is a guy who didn't just put up $1,100 once. He doesn't say how many times he put $1,100 up to bet on this, but I'm pretty certain, I'd bet $1,100 that it was a lot of times that he put that money into there. This is a person that I cannot fathom the amount of wealth that this guy has. Can you imagine that bet? You pay $1,100 and you get $700,000 back. One of my favorite stories that Lewis tells about this hedge fund manager is that he's sitting in his office and he talks to him about nickels, like 5-cent coins, right? Bass realized that a nickel, the metal in a nickel has become worth 6.8 cents. So he's gonna hold a couple nickels, right? Well, actually, he calls his bank and says, I want to buy $1 million worth of nickels. I want to buy $1 million worth of nickels. I wish I could call my bank and say, I want to buy $1 million worth of nickels. It's 20 million nickels for those that are trying to do the math and figure out how many that is. That's 20 million nickels. And the bank does this. They call and they place their order. I don't know how you do that, but they place an order for $1 million worth of nickels. And someone from the Federal Reserve calls them back and says, why do you want $1 million worth of nickels? And so they call Mr. Bass and they say, why do you want $1 million worth of nickels? And all he says to them and all he says to Michael Lewis is, I really like nickels. And so he has a picture and he shows it to Michael Lewis of, these are my 20 million nickels here in the basement of this huge vault that are ready, because he's convinced that pretty soon we're going to stop making nickels out of something that costs us 6.8 cents for something that's only worth 5 cents. And as soon as we do, he's going to literally have tons of coins that he's going to collect on this. Tons and tons. Can you imagine that? $1 million in nickels, 20 million coins secured in a vault. I really can't. And when I grew up as a young kid, I had those penny banks that I collected money in and things, but for me, mostly money was something that I just kind of took for granted. I grew up in a family where I was taught to love other folks and to be loved in really deep, profound, and simple ways by my parents and grandparents and people who loved and watched over us. The idea that we would need to store up money in that kind of a way just didn't compute or register for us. But our needs were really taken care of. I didn't know it at the time. It was just how it was. My mom was a teacher, and my dad was a manager for a truck line. And we had moved several times as my dad had climbed that corporate ladder. Maybe some of folks here have moved several times climbing those corporate ladders. What happened for us, though, right before I was in the eighth grade, was that that ladder that we climbed pretty high on, I didn't really know how high we were, it collapsed. And when you fall off of a ladder, it really hurts. It hurts physically, but there's an emotional piece of it too that I think about. See, you thought someone was holding that ladder. If you've been to Sierra Service Project, you have that ladder buddy. You think somebody is down there holding this for you, and then it collapses, and it just feels like there's nothing there. And that's the song, Busted, that we sang earlier. And so many of us have experienced it in our own ways and in our own times. For our family, it was a time in which we moved back to be with my grandparents. And it was a time in the eighth grade, it didn't make sense to me. I had never before asked for something and not just kind of had it handed to me on a silver platter. So maybe just in the eighth grade, your anger starts to well up in general, but it really did for me. Some parents out there resonate that this may not just be a busted experience, it might just be a teenage experience, but for me, the two were conflated together in those ways. It wasn't as though our family then was stacking away coins. We became like so many other families that were trying to figure out how you get by on scrap metal. It wasn't the bank vault. It was, how do we do this? What is going to happen? And I was fortunate in that family to be mostly protected from those experiences. I wasn't the one staying up late at night to try to figure out how to do that. But as any fall that happens, it affects everybody around. That's just what happens. No matter how phenomenal we are as parents at trying to keep the facade around children, it seeps through and it overwhelms us at various times and in various places. From 10,000 feet, what people would have said is that the economy in Central Texas at that time in the early 90s was just collapsing, the housing economy was. So there were foreclosure signs all over the place, kind of like here at this moment in time. But it was a regional experience rather than a national experience, so it didn't gain quite the attention. That's how we tend to look at all those things. From 10,000 feet, we call it a recession, or we say that a lot of foreclosures are on the rise. But when you get down on the ground, you see that those are real people. We're real people, flesh on bones, that we as folks, parents and kids, grandparents and single folks, it exposes this deep insecurity that we all find ourselves in at various moments, where it doesn't feel like we have any protection. That's the kind of world that we live in today. A smaller and smaller group of people are making tons, storing up nickels, and a larger and larger group of people are trying to figure out how you get by on scrap metal. And so that's why we wanted to have a worship series around faith and finances. Is we know everybody thinks, oh, the church, all they do is talk about money. Actually, I don't think the church really talks about money very much. What I think is tele-evangelists talk about money, and they're really skilled at inviting people to give them all of theirs. But the church hasn't really had complicated conversations about faith and money for a long, long time, at least not the churches that I've been a part of. And so we hope that these couple of weeks will just invite us to begin to move into that conversation together. Because let me tell you, Jesus was way more concerned about how we spend our financial resources and how we relate to possessions than about anything else. So we're going to try to touch into that over these couple of weeks. And to start with, I want to hope that this story in the book of Acts can help us find some good news. I want to share it one more time. Now the whole group of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and no one claimed private ownership of any possessions, but everything they owned was held in common. With great power, the apostles gave their testimony to the resurrection of Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. There was not a needy person among them, for as many as owned lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of what was sold. They laid the proceeds at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to each as they had need. That's what the church was like right after Jesus' resurrection. That's it. That's what the church was doing. After Jesus was died and rose again, that's what it looked like. So it was concerning to me last week on Easter when a famous pastor, his name is Rick Warren, he went on television, and these are his words in an interview on television. "Well, certainly the Bible says we're to care about the poor. There's over 2,000 verses in the Bible about the poor. And God says that those who care about the poor, God will care about them. God will bless them. But there's a fundamental question on the meaning of fairness. Does fairness mean everybody makes the same amount of money? Or does fairness mean everybody gets the opportunity to make the same amount of money? I do not believe in wealth redistribution. I believe in wealth creation." And I think, okay, fine, maybe you don't have to believe in wealth redistribution to follow Jesus in our day. Maybe you don't. But the story in Acts, they certainly believe in wealth redistribution in their day. They really believed in it. So it is definitely a biblical way of thinking, however you want to think about it. And this text gets us all caught up because people of different ideologies have argued about this text for a long time. Is this a reason to say that communism is the only way to go? Is this a critique of capitalism, of late capitalism, that we cannot hold things privately, we can only allow them to be shared in community? And people stand and they fight on different sides of what they believe about this text, but I think it misses the point. The point of this story isn't about a 21st century ideology of how to develop a macroeconomic system. The point of this text, I argue, is that the early church's call to hold everything in common, it has less to do with all those ways of thinking about how we share macro-wise. They matter about our own life as a community. How are we going to faithfully respond at this moment to Jesus' resurrection that is real and is all around us? Not what system of government or of economics are we going to argue for or against, but how are we going to live it out in our daily lives? And actually, Rick Warren, who I don't agree with on a whole list of things, he's a really good example of how to live it out in certain ways. In 2005, he wrote a book that became, he made billions, not billions, he made millions of dollars. See, I don't even know the difference, millions, billions. He made a lot of money. He made a lot of money, and what he did when he made that money was he wrote a check back to his church for the last 25 years of his salary. And he decided to do something that he calls reverse tithing. The Bible invites us to share the first 10% of what we gain with others. And Rick and his family decided that they would give 90% away and live on 10%. So he, in his own way, is living out a resurrection experience. He's turning what it means to gain money upside down. And I think that's what this story in Acts invites us to do. It tells the story of what it means to follow Jesus for those early folks that were on this side of Easter. What does it mean to root our lives in grace, to grow in faith, and to reach in love? And if you haven't looked through Acts in a while, it reads a lot like a police report, is what I would say. A lot like a police report. So you have Peter and John, they're getting arrested in chapter 4. And then you have all the apostles, they're all jailed and they're flogged. And they're told that they can no longer preach again. It's like a preaching restraining order is how one person talked about it. Stephen is stoned to death in chapter 7. They're all driven out of Jerusalem. A death bounty is on Paul's head by chapter 9. And then James is beheaded in chapter 12. Welcome to the resurrection life, people. This is what it looked like for the followers of Jesus who had just experienced something so powerful that they could not help but live differently. And living differently turns things upside down, and the powers that be can't handle it. That's why it reads like a police report. Because when we live out a resurrection life, we move into trouble. Folks don't like that. So I want to take a moment just to look at the text in a little bit more detail, because we get caught up in arguing about which system of economics does it espouse or does it critique. But really what it says to me is this, that the people received great grace. The Greek is mega charis. And that grace so changed them that they could not keep living the way that they had before. And so some of the folks sell all that they have. And all of the people, what they sell, they put at the apostles' feet, so the apostles distribute it to anyone who has need. Like, the resurrection was so real for them that they wanted to do something about it, not show up at church one time, but to live life differently. And that's actually what they started to do. Here's what I love, though. It's kind of like Michael Lewis' story. It's not just describing credit default swaps, right? It's not just saying, share everything that you have with one another. No, the author of Acts, Luke, he says that, he gives us some examples, some real people's flesh and bones to say, what does this actually look like? So he gives a positive example of what it looks like, and that is Barnabas. And Barnabas does it almost exactly what he's told. He sells off his property and lays it at the feet of the apostles. See, that's a way of saying, like, I'm going to worship not this stuff, but God, who seeks for all to have who don't at this moment. That's the positive example. That's the flesh and bones that we see in Acts of how we're called to live it out. But like a great writer, we also get some negative examples. And we've sung about one. We've sung about Ananias. Tell me what kind of man Jesus is. And some of you might have wondered, who is this Ananias guy? Well, keep going in Acts and you'll come right upon Ananias' story. And it's a negative story about what happens when we don't share in the ways that the community is called to. Ananias and his wife Sapphira, they are a little deceptive in how they relate to their money. And they don't sell all that they have. And it has grave consequences. And there's a pun that's intended there, because in biblical times, the grave consequences are these folks are literally put to death, is one way of reading the story. They did not share, they did not sell off all that they owned. And so they face grave consequences. And maybe some folks will want to read that story in a literal way, but I think metaphorically it may just represent the ways in which, as a dying community, either one by one or two by two, we die as a community when we choose to take care of ourselves over others. Rather than seeing ourselves and our relationship to community as interwoven, we just try to care for ourselves. And in that, we die as people and as a community. See, metaphorically, those two folks, Ananias and Sapphira, they're a lot more the majority in our world than Barnabas, who sells everything, at least in the world that I live in. But it's that life that we're called to wonder about this day, on this side of Easter. How does God invite us to relate to the resources around us, to hold the resources around us, to save the resources around us, to give those away? John Wesley, who was the founder of what became the Methodist movement, he wrote a sermon called The Use of Money. And this is his phrase: having first gained all you can, and secondly, saved all you can, then give all you can. Gain all you can, save all you can, then give all you can. We've been reflecting this week in Kitchen Tables about what that might look like for us today. And one of the college students from a Kitchen Table that meets on Tuesday, she wrote about it in a blog in this way: money is tight, business is down. It's like she could have written busted right here. Money is tight, business is down, and life is getting more expensive. But the way I see it, I have a great life. I live within my means, I live simply, and I appreciate what I have. It's not that I think everyone should give away their possessions. In fact, I think that would be a very bad idea. I don't feel good about myself for giving things away. I'm just at a place in my life where that's what I'm doing. As we get older, our responsibilities become greater. Right now, gaining all that I can looks like education and authentic relationships. It's a good foundation for gaining to come. I save a decent amount of money considering my lifestyle, and I'm in a place where I give what I can. I give my time, my ear, my experience, my belongings, and my money. I probably won't always be like this, but for now, appreciating the small things, helping without judgment, and living simply is exactly what life looks like for me. That's what resurrection life looks like. It's what the people who were responding to the resurrection in Acts felt and knew. It's how they shared. Wesley knows that this isn't going to be simple. It's not just going to be a one size fits all. Everyone, here is your answer. We all come from different places. And my experience of falling off that ladder when we were children was mine. But my sense is that we've all had those experiences. And they shape the ways we relate to money now in profound and complicated ways. So my invitation, our invitation for you this day, is to wonder about what stories, what people have shaped the way you relate to money. Some of those over these next couple weeks, we might need to name out loud and let go of. Actually, let those stories go. And other stories that we maybe haven't paid attention to, we may need to notice, to spend a little more time with. In terms of gaining all that we can, Wesley invites us to do so with these cautions in mind. Gain all that we can, but not at the expense of our health. Gain all that we can without damaging our souls. Gain all that we can without hurting our neighbor. See, in Proverbs, they write about it this way, and I love this. A thick bankroll is no help when life falls apart, but a principled life can stand up to the worst. And we're going to spend some time in the next couple of weeks reflecting on what that principled life might look like together in community. Next week, we're going to dare to talk about savings in a time in which all of us are overcome by credit and by loans and fear in all of those ways. What does saving look like in our lives? And then we're going to close this worship series with a time on giving. How might God be calling us to give away that which we might see as our own right now, but which our tradition teaches us to see as God's gift to us and to all? So for today, though, I want to end by inviting you to think about, what does it look like for you to gain all that you can? In 21st century America, that tends to be a really individual question. I am going to gain all that I can. And rarely do we pause to think about our own physical well-being, our own emotional well-being, our own soul, and certainly not about the souls of the neighbors around us that are affected by the choices that we make. How is it that you're going to gain all that you can? And how might the Acts community invite us to think differently about that question, not as an individual experience, but as a resurrection community? Perhaps gaining all we can is always relational, as resurrection is relational. May we practice that kind of resurrection.
I just want to send us to a time of prayer with these words to remember and to listen about. We practice resurrection as a community, all of us, when we gain all we can for the benefit of all of those who have need. What does that look like for you? What does it look like for your family? This is a new prayer song we'll be singing over the weeks. You can sit and listen and sing. Nicole will help us. But let's turn to God in prayer for now.
Lord, you are my precious.